You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Hi, everybody. I'm Kelly Evans. This is The Exchange, and stocks are moving lower today. Dow's down 308 right now, but we're still on pace to close out a monster month of gains and record highs. Is there more to come, or did we pull forward the Santa Claus rally? Plus, bullion versus Bitcoin. Gold getting pummeled while Bitcoin shoots back up nearly to all-time highs. We're going to look at the tug of war between these two investments. And with holiday shopping in full swing, we'll look at who could take the retail crown as shoppers move out of the store and online. But let's begin with the markets this hour. And Bob Bassani is here with the numbers for us. Hi, Bob.
Hello, Kelly. Good to see you as always. We are off of the lows, but not by much. 3-1 declining to advancing stocks. And not a surprise, we have a little bit of a pullback. There's not a lot of news to stimulate this little pullback that we've got. But considering the S&P 500 up 10, maybe 11%, we'll see how it ends up. This is in the top 10 months of all time that we've seen. Quite a move for the S&P. And if you look at what's down today, it's the stuff that's had the biggest move throughout the month. Those value stocks. What's value? It's mostly energy and bank stocks. That's what's down today. Cyclicals have had a big move. Industrials are classic cyclicals. They're down as well. Meantime, tech's been up 10% on the month and holding up okay. No big sell-off there. So this is that Goldilocks scenario. Everything's up. Look at this. Everybody in the pool. Energy. Banks up 30% here on energy. Industrial strong. Technology up 10%. Even healthcare, which is a defensive stock and consumer staples, they're up. This is what the Goldilocks scenario looks like. Everything is moving really nicely. Now, what's behind this little pullback that we've seen? If you look at energy today, a lot of uncertainty around what's going on with OPEC, but these stocks have moved 30% in the last several weeks. Some of these refiners like Holly have been through the roof under the theory we're all going to start driving dramatically sometime in February, March, or April, obviously getting a little bit ahead of themselves. What's behind the pullback? Well, I think you basically know. There's not a lot of news today, but just think of what's been going on here. We've had record highs in the last couple of days. We have extreme levels of bullishness. Everybody thinks the market's going to go straight up. That's never a good sign. And finally, that Goldilocks scenario I keep talking about. Vaccine hopes that it's going to be smooth. That's a lot of assumption in that. Stimulus, we're going to get that. A lot of assumptions in there. And of course, this glorious spring reopening. Let's hope, all of us, that we get that in the second quarter. But there's a lot of things that could happen between now and that glorious reopening in March and April. Kelly, back to you, guys.
There certainly are. Bob, we appreciate it. Our Bob Bassani running through the markets. We had some updates on the COVID vaccine front today as well. Solid results from Moderna in seriously ill patients and the company officially filing with the FDA for emergency use. Shares are still up more than 15%. Novavax is also up about 13% today, even though it once again pushed back the start of its own vaccine trial. Meg Terrell has the latest for us. Hi, Meg.
Hi, Kelly. Well, it wouldn't be a Monday in November without more vaccine news, as you pointed out last week. So Moderna getting the final efficacy look at its phase 3 trial for its COVID vaccine, coming in at 94.1% effective. That's after they had 196 total cases in the trial, with a split of 185 of those in the placebo group and just 11 on the vaccine. They also saw 30 cases of severe disease, and those were all among people who did not get the vaccine, suggesting 100% efficacy against severe COVID-19. In terms of safety, it appeared well tolerated. No serious safety concerns that they've observed to date. And Moderna is saying it's going to file today for emergency use authorization with the FDA. Similar filing, it's going to file in Europe with the European Medicines Agency. Now, we talked with Moderna's CEO, Stéphane Bancel, this morning about what he was most excited about in these results. And here's what he said.
The most exciting news to me yesterday when I learned the data was the severe cases, because if we can prevent severe cases, it means, you know, reduced or no hospitalization and no death. And that will be, of course, I believe, a game changer in this pandemic.
So Moderna filing with the FDA today, saying that they expect a meeting of the FDA's outside advisors December 17th. That's a week after the December 10th date for Pfizer's vaccine to get that review from the FDA. And here's a look at the other vaccines in development in the United States. We, of course, got those initial AstraZeneca phase 3 results from other countries last week. J&J's results are expected by the end of the year or early January. And Novavax today updating on its U.S. trial, saying that should begin within a few weeks. But that is a delay. You know, originally we'd been hearing October for their start, then November. We talked with Novavax's CEO Stan Erck this morning as well. He said it's just sort of normal figuring out the manufacturing that resulted in this delay. And here's what he told us about the prospects for their vaccine.
it's good news for everybody that the protein that's being used as an antigen to stimulate an immune response is the right protein to use. It's the spike protein. Our data shows that we had very high levels of protective antibody at T cells against the spike protein. So that's, I think that's predicts a good result for our vaccine trials as well.
Now, Kelly, here's a look at why more vaccines are potentially needed than just the Pfizer and Moderna ones, even though they've shown such good results. If we have it, we can show you the supply deals that Operation Warp Speed has struck for these vaccines. You can see here the blue is what they've ordered. The yellow is options to order more. Now, for Moderna and Pfizer, the U.S. government has struck deals for 100 million doses. These are two-shot vaccines. That's enough for 50 million people each. And that won't come all at once. It'll be staggered over a period of months. Now, Novavax, they've also struck a deal for 100 million doses. So in order to be able to cover the entire country, they either need to exercise the options of more vaccines from Moderna or Pfizer, or some of these other vaccines need to work, Kelly. So this is the situation we're looking at right now. Back over to you.
And so, Meg, I'm curious how much stock people are putting on the Novavax vaccine in the first place, but also, you know, with AstraZeneca, and that was a lot of drama last week over the reliability of its test results. I understand that people don't like sort of the happenstance by which that positive number, that 90% number came about, but how quickly can they move into getting that more solidified so that people can figure out, okay, well, if the half dose and full dose combo, you know, is a really good result, that can move along quickly as well?
I think there are so many variables there. It depends on what the data show when they are able to present all of it. You know, they publish it in a journal, they release all of it so everybody can see it and dig through it. And then the other variable is how regulators look at it and how comfortable they are with whatever level of uncertainty still remains once they see all of the data. A big question is, why would a half dose be more effective than a full dose when given before another full dose? And there are a number of hypotheses about that. So the question is, will the United States, for us here in America, will the FDA be comfortable accepting those data from outside the U.S. and with a lot of questions about them, or will they want more data? Will we need to see the trial that's being run in the U.S. be changed in order to test the vaccine in the new way that proved to be more effective? So just a lot of questions about the AstraZeneca vaccine right now, which we hope we'll get answers to over the coming weeks to months.
Yeah, exactly. And that they can do it as quickly as possible, you know, in the best way they can. Meg, thanks so much for rounding it all up for us. Our Meg Terrell. And this is the first Monday in almost a month that we haven't seen positive vaccine news spur a huge rally. In fact, the Dow was down nearly 450 points at the lows, but we have locked in some pretty huge gains for November already. The Dow's on track for its best month since 1987. The S&P and NASDAQ on track for about their best month since April, but better than 10% gains for both. And the rally this month has been broad, with every sector higher and all but one of them up at least 6%. Joining me now, David Hardin is President and Chief Investment Officer at Summit Global Investments, and Nancy Pryle is co-CEO and Senior Portfolio Manager at Essex Investment Management. Welcome to both of you. And David, first of all, Andy Kessler had a thoughtful piece in the journal over the weekend where he kind of said, you know, beware this market. And if you kind of look beneath the surface, there's a lot of companies, especially the big tech companies, that he thinks are overvalued. Would you agree with that? Or do you think that this market still has plenty of room to run?
Well, I agree that there is some overbought positions, and there's a lot of companies that have done very well. But take a look at, like, you know, Amazon, which is not really in the tech sector, but it is a tech company. It's up over 70%. It has a PE of 90. But if you look at the news from Black Friday, people are shopping online. That's very, very positive for that company. And so there are some companies out there that are overbought. I'd be very careful here. But in the same respect, I think you still want to be in certain companies.
So, David, who are the companies that you'd want to be in? Is that basket include the reopening names, whatever, you know, if you want to call them that? You know, do they include different kind of growth stories within tech? Where would you be?
Yeah, so I mentioned one with Amazon there. Another place that I really think is a great buy, whether the vaccine comes sooner, which we all hope it does, great news today, or later, and that's like Walmart. I think Walmart had a great online number there at 79% growth in its online sales. But also, if we open back up, I think there are more people at the store. Target's another one with the reopening. I think their in-store sales has been off the charts fantastic. And so that's another great company there that I would recommend. And then if you want to look at still tech, but doing well in the cloud, I think long-term trends, you're looking at Microsoft from a very big name or a very small name like Cloudflare. Both of those names doing very, very okay. Well.
Nancy, meanwhile, we talked last week about just how extreme sentiment has gotten, you know, whether it was the II survey, the fear and greed index, the CNN fear and greed index. Those trends do continue. So we know at some point we're going to see a pullback, a correction. I guess the question is, you know, how deep, how severe, and do we emerge with new leadership?
Well, so we do expect to see a pullback. As you've mentioned, II numbers are very strong. There's been a lot of individual participation in the market, which is fantastic, but has led to some level of speculation, some level of froth, particularly in some of the very exciting emerging growth areas like electric vehicles and some of the vaccine stocks. So we would expect to see a pullback. We think that the pullback should be relatively narrow, but we think coming out of that pullback, we are setting the stage for what could be a fairly major reversal in the market. As you know, we've had about a dozen years of growth leading value. We've had 5 years, almost 6 years, of mega cap growth leading pretty much everything else. And that's made sense because that's where the growth has been and that's where the valuations were most attractive. What we see now looking forward is actually a switch of those growth, not away from tech, and not away from digital transformation and personalized medicine and all of these exciting areas, but away perhaps from some of the most expensive ways to play that into some of the less expensive ways. And so we see a market that can emerge as a market where you have what we like to call Goldilocks stocks. Not too hot, so not the super highly valued stocks that have been the winners so far year to date and really for the past 5 years.
Right.
Not too cold, not the deep value, but in the middle, good growth, good valuation, industrials, hardware, some of the healthcare areas, some of the consumer areas, et cetera.
Right. And I know that you guys do a lot of focus on small caps. You have names like Lumentum, Patrick Industries, and Pluralsight that you like specifically. Nancy, just before I let you go, I'm curious what you think about, you know, if I were somebody who was in an index fund, whether it's an ETF, a mutual fund in my retirement, you name it, do I need to be concerned about Tesla coming into the S&P 500 next month? We'll talk more of this later in the show, this huge name. Mm-hmm. I mean, would you have any advice for kind of the typical investor out there? Do they just ignore it? Is it something to kind of try to, I don't know, what do you think about how big it's gotten and its inclusion in the S&P?
Right. And so certainly there is going to be some impact of Tesla coming in. It's the math of it's going to come in at a relatively large weighting. And so it will displace some of the smaller names in the benchmark. And there could be some short-term volatility about it. What we would suggest for individual investors is that the scarcity in the market today is actually looking at long-term investments and investing for the long term. We think you could, if you will, fade it a little by taking advantage of big up days and trimming a little, taking advantage of big down days and adding. But overall, you want to pick your asset allocation. You want to go back to the old idea of dollar cost averaging. And you want to have a good core position in index funds to give you broad market participation and then add some extra value elsewhere, whether it's through specialized index funds, whether it's through individual stock picking in those areas that you think have the best growth possibilities over the intermediate term.
All right, so you can kind of ignore it as long as you have a long enough time horizon, I guess, not retiring December 21. Nancy
exactly.
And David, thank you both for sharing your thoughts on the market today. We appreciate
thank you,
it.
Thank you very much.
Nancy Pryle, David Horvers. Turning now to retail, we saw some monster numbers out of Black Friday. In-store traffic plunged by more than 50%. Online sales soared 21%. My next guest says holiday spending overall could be up 10% this year. That would be the strongest holiday season in two decades, although he warns we could see a bigger than usual spending valley in December. Joining me now is Chris Horvers. He's the retail hardlines analyst at JP Morgan. Chris, it's great to have you. And for someone like you to say we could be up 10% and holiday spending really catches my attention. How so?
Well, it's all about owning the winners. If you look at most of my coverage, we're benefiting from a massive $300 billion share of wallet shift to things from entertainment and experiences. So covering companies like Home Depot and Costco and Best Buy and Target, they're gaining a lot of share around eat at home, learn from home, work from home, the excitement around the toys category this year, the excitement around the new gaming platforms with PlayStation and Xbox. So, you know, the categories that are getting hit really hard, it's eating out, it's travel, as you know, hotels and airlines, and also apparel and beauty. That's a minority of spending as you take a look at core retail sales. And core retail sales has been growing in the double-digit range over the past couple months.
So to be clear, Chris, do you think we're up 10% just for your coverage universe or for the whole sector?
The whole sector, November and December combined. If you look at a regression analysis to back-to-school spending, which was up strong in the double-digit range, it's about 99% correlated to holiday sales. So if you think about those home categories, that the work from home, the electronics, and so forth, those categories will be very strong year over year. It's going to be at the expense of apparel.
Up 4%. Yeah,
yes.
I mean, so it's just incredible to hear you say that we could be up 10%. That would easily be the best holiday in a couple of decades. You talked about the spending valley in December. What is that? How severe is that? Is that just a bump along the road, or how does that work?
Yeah, so what you're going to see is that retailers spread out their promotions. It actually started with Prime Day in mid-October with a lot of retailers trying to, you know, also promote about that. So you're pulling holiday promotions earlier. So most companies that ahead of Black Friday, I think we're ahead of plan across my coverage. But with Black Friday being closed on Thanksgiving on Thursday, Black Friday, you talked about the mall traffic and traffic overall being down significantly. We're going to start to see this divot in the holiday spending because you would have pulled forward. As you get closer to Christmas, however, given that UPS and FedEx are restricting when you can get a package delivered by Christmas, a lot of retailers talking about order by December 15th to guarantee delivery in time for Christmas, you'll see a strong bump at the end in brick and mortar traffic, because the consumer is going to need to go to the stores. So you see companies like Costco and Best Buy and Target, which has fantastic click and collect options, being big winners late in the season.
Yeah, I know that Target, you think, could be the big winner. Walmart maybe a little bit lesser so. Chris, thanks for joining us. We'll check back in as we move along here. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Chris Horvers of J.P. Morgan on the holiday sales season. Still to come, Main Street confidence, such an interesting juxtaposition with what we were just talking about. Out on Main Street, it's confidence at an all-time low, according to a CNBC poll. There's some positive signs in small business, though, next in hiring and revenues. We'll tell you about that. But plus, Bitcoin hitting an all-time high with some investors saying that gold's pain is becoming Bitcoin's gain. There it is, 19,200 and change. We'll delve into that coming up on The Exchange.
This is The Exchange on CNBC.
Welcome back to The Exchange. Main Street confidence has hit a new low amid the pandemic, although there are some signs of a rebound in hiring and revenues. Kate Rogers is here now with those details. Kate?
Hey, Kelly, we all know this has been a challenging year for small businesses, but there are a few silver linings in our new CNBC SurveyMonkey small business poll for Q4. Nearly 4 in 10 businesses say that their company's revenue has increased in the last 3 months. That is up from 25% last quarter. Those saying that revenue has decreased fell from 51% last quarter to 36% in Q4, and 41% say that demand has increased. That's up from 35% in July. Though those trends are not translating right now to hiring, 11% say that their headcount has increased this quarter, while 18% say it has decreased. Overall, 18% say that conditions are bad. That's down from a high of 40% during the beginning of the crisis. 39% now say that their conditions are good. That's a slight uptick from last quarter. And 67% say that they can continue to operate for a year or more. That number is unchanged. All that being said, though, Kelly, you did mention confidence did dip this quarter to a score of 48. That is the lowest level it's been since we began polling back in 2017.
Yeah, and no surprise. I mean, this has got to be the worst crisis possible if you're Main Street, Kate. We were just talking about Target and Walmart and all the big box stores and how well they're doing. I mean, it's just, it's unfair. Mm-hmm. It's also interesting to see that figure that two-thirds of Main Street businesses think they can operate for another year, which on the one hand you could say is encouraging. On the other hand, kind of terrifying if a third of them, if that implies a third of them can't.
Yeah, that's certainly true. And we have to remember there are a lot of unknowns here, not only with the virus, they're also in between administrations here. Some business owners polled said that they were expecting, of course, tax policy changes, potential changes to immigration policy. I think that could be weighing on them as well. We've seen dips like this, though, before, particularly around tariffs. But as you mentioned, this is unprecedented. So a lot of uncertainty on Main Street, not only in our polling, but other small business polls as well, Kelly.
Yeah, it could be a difficult period of time from now until more aid if it is coming. Kate, thank you. Our Kate Rogers.
Thanks.
Coming up, Tesla's market cap has gotten so big that its addition to the S&P next month may have to be split over 2 days. We're going to look at all the money that will be set into motion as a result. Plus, Wall Street analysts think it's time to focus on companies that will emerge from the pandemic stronger than ever. We've got the names they're most bullish on right now. And don't forget, you can always watch us live on the go using the CNBC app. The Exchange is back in a couple. Welcome back to The Exchange. Let's get a check on the markets. The low for the Dow was down 446 today. We're down 325 right now. About a 1% drop, again, to cap off a monster month for all three major averages. The S&P is down 23 right now. The Nasdaq's down 45. So it is the Dow underperforming. All 11 sectors are in the red. All 11 today. Energy and financials, the biggest laggard. So again, this definitely has a bit of a anti-reopening feel to it in the market today. You can see energy down 3.5%. And in terms of the individual movers, Nikola is the big story today. It's sharply lower on the news that GM is giving up an equity stake. They reworked, got a smaller deal that will still be done between the two companies. But GM will also no longer build that Badger, the pickup truck of Nikola that had been so controversial. And Nikola shares are down 24%, GM down a little less than 2%. And in potentially the biggest deal of the year, shares of IHS Markit are higher after it will officially be acquired by S&P Global for $44 billion. So a market is rallying more than 7% right now. Deal is expected to close in the second half of next year. But again, $44 billion deal, that's the biggest of 2020 yet. And shares of JetBlue were lower after the airline said it expects Q4 revenue to decline by 70%. That was sharper than previously estimated, and it's down about 3% today. Now let's get to Sue Herrera for our CNBC News update. Hi, Sue.
Hi, Kelly. Good to see you. Hello, everybody. Here's what's happening at this hour. Prison officials in South Carolina say they won't be able to proceed Friday with the state's first execution in almost a decade because they can't get the lethal injection drugs they need. Many drug makers are refusing to sell those drugs to states with the death penalty. New Jersey's governor is sharply reducing the limit for outdoor gatherings and canceling all indoor youth and school sports through the end of the year amid rising COVID case counts. 2020 isn't over yet, but thankfully, for many who have felt its wrath, this year's Atlantic hurricane season ends today. Delta, which hit Louisiana last month, is just one of a record-breaking 30 named storms, more than double the average of just 12. And as one season ends, far away, another is beginning. Look at that. Beautiful. From central China, some gorgeous winter scenes as falling temperatures over the past week brought heavy snow to an historic site in Henan province. You are up to date? I could look at that all day. Kelly, I'll send
gorgeous.
It back to you.
That is really something. Sue, thank you,
you
so much.
It.
We appreciate it. Sue Herrera. Let's check the markets, which are lower today, but the Dow is on pace for its best month since January of 1987. Investors are focusing on the post-COVID recovery, and CNBC Pro has combed through Wall Street research for what they say are long-term buying opportunities. One of those bullish calls on the street is on Lyft from KeyBank, the firm saying Lyft is poised to benefit from cities reopening as people will avoid public transportation still for the time being. Shares of Lyft are up nearly 70% over the past month. They're trimming about 1% today. Wells Fargo says Capri Holdings, the parent company of brands like Michael Kors and Jimmy Choo, is attractive as the luxury space is alive and well. They also noted that workwear and dress categories will bounce back next year. Shares of Capri have soared 67% this month. They're down about 1% today. And you can find the rest of the names and analysis behind these picks at cnbc.com/pro. Coming up, Bitcoin breaks out big time. The street gets more bullish on Apple, and Salesforce isn't slacking off on a deal. Plus, why one strategist says gold is headed to new highs despite its recent sell-off. It's coming up in a couple of minutes. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back. Let's catch you up on a few stories that should be on your radar today. It is time for Rapid Fire. Here to break down the headlines are Michael Santoli, Seema Modi, and John Fort. And it's great to have everybody here. And we are going to start with Bitcoin, which after a horrible Thanksgiving reversed to a record high today. It shook off that big sell-off last week. Thought we'd be talking about that, but no. Then today it just soared. Look at the price now, 19,200. It topped 19,640, which is according to CNBC its previous high watermark. Seema spoke with Tyler and Cameron Winklevoss, the co-founders of the crypto exchange Gemini, about the boom earlier today. Here's what Tyler said about how high it could go.
Our thesis is that Bitcoin is gold 2.0, that it will disrupt gold. And if it does that, it has to have a market cap of $9 trillion. So we think that prices Bitcoin at, it could price one day at $500,000 a Bitcoin. So at $18,000 Bitcoin, it's a hold, or at least if you don't have any, it's a buy opportunity because we think there's a 25X from here.
Seema, here is my question I've been pondering all morning. So you got to enlighten me. Okay. I get that people say there's only 21 million Bitcoin and all the institutions are going to pile in now and there's going to be demand from everywhere to fix supply. But what about, tell me what's been going on with all the other cryptos, like the Ripples and Ethereum. And has everybody else got a fixed supply? Because like, why couldn't you and I start Seema Coin and Kelly Coin? And we'd be like, all right, there's only going to be, 200 ever. And everyone else can start piling in. And why can't we have a million of these things? And at some point, will they become competitors to Bitcoin and maybe, upset that supply demand Apple Card somewhat?
I think we can. We can do this right after Rapid Fire, create that coin. But here's the thing. There's still a level of recognition that Bitcoin holds over the other cryptocurrencies and digital coins out there that has given it sort of a lead amidst all the others. And I think, Tyler and Cameron, they have been overtly bullish, painting this narrative for quite some time. The only difference is here in 2020, they're being joined by a select group of hedge fund investor types, many of whom you've spoken to exclusively, Kelly, on your show, about them warming up to the prospects of Bitcoin. But context here is these two individuals, after that $65 million lawsuit with settlement with Facebook, $11 million they put into Bitcoin back into 2013, reportedly. And since then, they've just ridden Bitcoin up. And now it's a big part of their personal net worth. So clearly, they have that very much invested interest in seeing this cryptocurrency continue to move higher.
Yeah. And I'm going to ask Mike about the gold thing in a second. But John, if we go back to what Stan Druckenmiller was saying, this was not like a big, bold, bullish call he was making on Bitcoin. He just kind of said, look, I recognize it has staying power. And he said, I also recognize a lot of the new money out west, for instance, will go into Bitcoin. I mean, how much do you think that is what is driving the latest leg up here? And how much is it the fact that now with PayPal, and some of these other Square that you can more easily access
this,
it.
This is crazy, Kelly. I mean, you ask what's driving it. Toonce is the driving cat, I think, is driving it. So I'm not telling anybody to be long Bitcoin. I'm not telling anybody to be short it. It's just nobody can explain to me what makes it go up and down. You look at a one-year chart of Bitcoin and think about what's been happening in the world. It just doesn't make any sense. Like, why does it move the way it moves? So if you want to gamble, if you enjoy that, then go ahead. Everybody's got a theory. Somebody's got a theory it's going to double. The Winklevi think it's going to go up 25X. Sure, have fun. But unless you as an investor have a reason why you think this thing moves, be very careful.
So, Mike, let's talk about their analogy, which is actually the same reason why Bill Miller has been bullish on Bitcoin for years, because he said, look, if people start to treat it like gold and put just a fraction of their portfolios in it, that's a huge amount of wealth, whether it's $9 trillion or some other figure. Sure. The fact that Bitcoin's been up while gold's been down, would you link those two together, say that people are piling in gold 2.0?
You know, you can't prove a negative. You can't prove it's not why, Bitcoin is going up relative to gold. What it does get to, though, is, in fact, everything we've said here gets to is assets don't need to exist in the world if they're not really attached to some kind of a cash flow. But sometimes they get to a point where people all collectively agree, hey, this is an asset. It's non-correlated. It has a role in my portfolio. And that goes for gold. What's fascinating about it is the premise of owning gold long term has always been, hey, it's been money for thousands of years. You smarter than people for the last 5,000 years? And now it's a totally opposite thing, which is something conjured in a bit of software code 12 years ago is suddenly going to take the place of something that's been money forever, and that's why it's money today. And so I think that we have to come back to this idea. This is Bill Thesis creep, by the way, because it's not about the ledger. It's not about it's going to disrupt every other kind of transaction in the world. It's just, hey, it's worth something because we've seen it's worth something.
No, and it's true. There's nothing that bothers Mike Santoli quite like thesis creep. That is one thing, you know. Other things are forgivable, but we remember. Yeah. All right, if you think Bitcoin is wild, just wait till you hear what's going on with Tesla, because the stock is set to join the S&P 500 on December 21st. Normally, that joining would be pretty ho-hum, but not with Tesla, because it is so massive now. The Journal detailed the care asset managers and trading desks. Even the S&P itself is taking when it comes to this move, because inclusion could easily put more than $100 billion into motion. As things stand, Tesla would be the sixth largest component in the S&P after the big five mega cap tech companies. Its weighting would be so massive from day one, there's a debate over whether to add it all on one day or spread it over 2 days, Mike, or even to spread it out over two quarters, which is what MSCI did with China a few years ago. I mean, I understand that S&P's inclusion has been a catalyst for Tesla's latest move higher, but a $500 billion company, it makes no sense to me.
It's amazing. And the farther the stock goes up before it gets in, the more friction it creates upon entry. Now, the index funds are not just going to sit there and wait and buy every share the day it goes in. There's a way to scale, and there's a way of getting exposure incrementally and trying to be smart about the execution of it. It's not terribly different than 10 plus years ago when Berkshire Hathaway went in. At a similar size relative to the total market cap, it was a much less volatile stock, though. It was not something that was going to necessarily get away from the index funds. Now, the thing about Tesla is the stock itself trades an enormous amount of dollar volume every single day. $30 to $40 billion is routine on a one-day basis for Tesla. It's much more about what happens to the rest of the index as we have that push and pull of Tesla getting in.
And that's, John, what people are saying is the fact that it's so liquid should help. But would you apply what you said about trying to figure out Bitcoin to figuring out Tesla's share price?
It's like I'm an old man today yelling, get off my lawn. But this scares me. It's like a meteor heading toward the S&P 500. Comparing it to Berkshire Hathaway, it's a little bigger in market cap right now, I think, than Berkshire Hathaway. And it's like the opposite kind of company. Berkshire Hathaway, you know, Warren Buffett, boring, don't understand technology, kind of, you know, steady as she goes. Tesla's just been on this amazing tear. I defer in all analysis to Mike Santoli. But boy, I mean, even if I'm just holding an S&P 500 index fund, I'm worried about Tesla's effect, much less on Tesla itself.
It's going to be 1% just about of the index. So there you go.
It's a big number. We should hear from S&P possibly today or any moment now over how exactly they're going to do this. But stay tuned, everybody, because that's going to be a difficult one, just the maneuvering of it. Let's move on to talk about a pair of bullish calls on Apple today, which now looks like a minnow compared to everything else. Maybe not quite a minnow. It's still a $2 trillion company. But Loop just upgraded the stock to a buy with $131 target. Maybe a little late, you could say. They see a number of catalysts, including upside in Macs, iPad sales, services, revenue opportunities from the watch and AirPods. Morgan Stanley, meanwhile, raising its iPhone shipment forecast. And Morgan's bull case is Katie Huberty now. Again, her bull case, not base case, but is $191 now. She notes Apple has the highest percentage of users likely to upgrade their phones next year in the U.S. and China. Seema, I mean, that's, again, we're talking about the big getting bigger here. But in Apple's case, you have this idea that, you know, gross margins are peaking and, you know, 2021 could be a very different year. And what do you think about her point about upgrades in the U.S. and China?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting now when you see these reports on Apple, it's no longer just a call on the stock. It's like one of those global outlook, you know, 2021 macro reports, because there's just so much to dig into with a company like Apple, its sheer size, and obviously the different touch points it has within technology. You know, what really featured prominently in that Morgan Stanley report was the power of the iPad in consumer households just going forward. Second wave of lockdowns, this just means that we're going to be relying more on this type of accessory and technology going forward. I don't know about you, Kelly, but the hot topic at dinner over Thanksgiving was Netflix. What are you watching? And it wasn't just sharing ideas about, oh, The Crown on Netflix, Undoing on HBO. It was really getting into the story, the analysis of characters. You know, Princess Diana, was that true or false? A great, you know, depiction of her. But I think it all goes back to not just these streaming giants, but these devices that we're using to consume this content, right?
I know. And now I'm trying to think, did we even watch it? I think we're watching A Little Baby Bum on Netflix, and that's it. John, I'll just let you weigh in on, I don't think you're going to be like the old man shouting people get off your lawn on the Apple story, right? I mean, that's just a very profitable company.
That's right, kids, back on the lawn. This one we can actually like conceive of because, in part, Apple's got this new M1 chip out that, not perfect, but for a first effort, it's amazing. It's powering the new generation of Macs. You think about the gross margin implications of that, of Apple doing the main chip in-house, not having to pay Intel. That could pay amazing dividends over time. Plus this move that Apple has made over the past few days to sort of pacify small business on the App Store. If you're investing in Apple, you're bullish probably on the services business growth and the services margin over time. They possibly took a little risk, even regulatory risk, off the table by making this slight concession that's not going to cost them too much in revenue to small businesses.
Yeah, and I've been fascinated reading about that chip. It makes me want an Apple laptop. Again, that's absolutely a space to watch. We got to go, but Mike, real quickly, just curious your thoughts. As David Faber's been reporting, we may be very close to a Salesforce Slack deal. Salesforce is announcing earnings after the bell tomorrow. What should investors need to look for in that?
Well, I mean, obviously the specifics of the dollars changing hands. Salesforce stock actually on the weak side today. People may be worried about a little indigestion, the valuation being paid for. But it seems like strategically, I think the logic is pretty intuitive to everybody in terms of Slack being folded into that suite of offerings, maybe much more of a feature or a product than it was, you know, a thriving public company. So it seems like, you know, it makes sense as a fit together right here.
Yeah, it all feels, this theme of this whole rapid fire feels like a transition from kind of the old to the new, just at what price, I guess. Thank you all so much for your time today. John Fort, Mike Santoli, and Seema Modi. That does it for now. Still ahead, retailers are lower today with consumer discretionary, one of the day's biggest laggards. And this season, consumers are going contactless and biding their time in hopes for big discounts. We'll take a look at some 2020 shopping trends right after this. Welcome back to The Exchange. Today, Cyber Monday, is expected to be the largest day ever for digital sales in this country, with spending expected to reach as much as $13 billion, up 35% from a year ago. What does the surge mean for shipping? And are supply chains ready to handle what some are calling Shipageddon? For more, I'm joined by Frank Poore. He's the founder and CEO of Commerce Hub. Frank, how are they managing so far?
So far, things seem to be on track, but it's clear that things are going to slow down as we get into the throes of the season. You know, the likes of UPS and FedEx are quite taxed right now, and I think it's only going to get worse as we get closer to the holiday.
Yeah, and I know you guys work with over 15,000 different retailers. So, you know, FedEx and UPS have seen this coming for months. We know that, I can tell you, anytime I shop somewhere, whether it was for Advent supplies or you name it, they say order early, you know, try to avoid, you know, if it takes Amazon an extra day to get me my basics, you know, kind of expect that. How are all the different players dealing with this surge and passing off the volume that they don't need or want right now?
Well, in general, they're trying to load balance, right? They're trying to figure out, is there a way that we can make sales now and start to, you know, sort of flatten the curve, if you will, on the order volumes and be able to bring them earlier into the cycle. So You know, a lot of these retailers have already started their promotions. They started them before Thanksgiving. We're seeing a lot of volume this week online. Most commerce is becoming e-commerce, whether you're doing curbside pickup, that sort of thing. But we're seeing a huge surge online, given the fact that people don't want to go into stores and compete for a big screen TV right now.
And I'm also curious, I'm looking at your top holiday category so far. Number one is lighting. Is that normal?
You know, it's not a normal year, so I would say that it's probably par for this year. But I would say that things that are really helping out in the home, you know, people want to be comfortable. So home goods are starting to really do well. People want to feel good. So certainly beauty, wellness, and health. And obviously the entertainment around electronics, video games, that sort of thing seem to be the real big sellers so far this year.
Yeah, I know. I'm looking for some external Christmas lights myself. But just now I want someone to put them up for me. You know, that's the whole package. Uh-huh. They can send that too. That's the hardest part.
That would be great.
Frank, thanks for joining us. Keep us posted here as we see how the season goes as it gets into full swing. But thanks so much for your time today. That's Frank Poore with Commerce Hub. Still ahead, despite closing out one of its worst months in years, our strategist says that gold is getting ready to hit all-time highs. Why? And how high will it go? That's next. Welcome back. Gold hitting a five-month low today as Bitcoin surges. In fact, gold has sunk more than 10% since peaking just above $2,000 an ounce in August, and it's on pace for its worst month now since 2016. But my next guest is bullish, saying a mix of economic catalysts should help it rally to a new record high in 2021. For more, let's bring in Scott Wren. He's senior global market strategist for the Wells Fargo Investment Institute. Scott, it's good to have you. Most people are predicating their bullishness on gold on the weak dollar. Are you one of them?
Kelly, I think that's really part of it. And there's a pretty good inverse relationship. When the dollar's weak, gold has a tendency to rally. And that's certainly what's happened this year. Now, gold's up, even with this pullback we've had, about 17% year to date. And when you look at the dollar index, it's only down about 5%. But we're looking for the dollar index to trade modestly lower. But I think, you know, I'm an old school guy. You know, it's hard for me to break the, you know, gold inflation kind of relationship. And clearly we have very low inflation. It'll probably move up a little bit this year. But for us, I think a big part of this, besides a little bit lower dollar, is, you know, every major government out there, every major central bank is printing a lot of money that's not going to stop anytime soon. All of these major currencies have depreciated relative to gold. That's really been where people have been going. So I think as you're in a low real interest rate world, you've got central banks printing a lot of money. And I think those are really two gigantic factors that are going to help gold between now and the end of 2021.
And how high, Scott, do you think it's going to go next year? Because there are others out there, your colleagues on the street with different calls, I think in the $2,100, $2,300 range. Where are you?
We're at 2150 is the midpoint of our range for year in 2021. So Kelly, really what, you know, for us, you know, you've got a good pullback here. And what you need to start doing is looking for spots to step in. I mean, if you think these central banks are going to keep printing money, if you think real interest rates are going to stay low, if you think the dollar is going to be a little bit lower, you know, you need to start looking at spots. And now, you know, probably really a good technical spot's about $100 lower than this, but I think you can kind of leg in on the way down. You can put some money to work here. Mm-hmm. And if we're correct, and that 2150 is a realistic target out there, that's a nice return between now and the end of 2021.
Yeah, and I thought I was going to ask you all about Bitcoin, but, you know, I guess we'll have to leave that to the side because my last question.
I'm not an expert on Bitcoin at all.
No, more peeling off the gold demand, you know, is it siphoning right. The gold demand into Bitcoin? But I think the fundamental question I just want to quickly ask you is, what about the guys like Dave Zervos who say they think we're in the handoff phase of the recovery? Yes, we have big deficits now. Yes, we had a lot of, you know, monetary support, but it's handing off to a self-sustaining recovery. And as that happens, real rates are going to rise. It's going to support the dollar and be a headwind for gold.
Well, we're certainly, I mean, we're looking for 3.8% GDP next year, so we're certainly expecting a pretty decent bounce back. But the key for us is that we're not expecting interest rates or inflation to rise very much. We think inflation will be less than half of the longer 60-year average. So we're not expecting much inflation. We're expecting a little bit more. And we don't think this government deficit spending is going to go away anytime soon. You know, we both know that on either side of the aisle, Republicans, Democrats, they like to spend money. We're in the middle of a pandemic, hopefully at the tail end of it. And it's probably a multi-year situation here. We're going to be running some pretty good sized deficits.
All right, very good. Scott, thanks for making your case today. Scott Wren of Wells Fargo, we appreciate it. That does it for The Exchange, everybody. Thank you for tuning in, but stick around for Power Lunch. Energy is on track for its best month ever. Is there more room to run? And if so, what names should you buy? I will join Tyler Matheson after this quick break.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day, same time, same place.